Good afternoon. My name is Rebecca Thompson-Hitt, and I am here with APA, and this is our Monday Live series. And this month is part of our Birth Psychology Month, so we are getting to talk to some really incredible people. And today, you are so lucky to get the opportunity to get to spend some time with Michael Mendiza and his Touch the Future Academy. He has created, interviewed an amazing set of visionaries, of people who really, really understand babies and children. And he's created this, it's called Touch the Future Academy. You're going to get a sneak peek at that. And as Michael has said, we're going to be connecting the dots today in ways that you normally wouldn't be able to connect the dots. So I am so delighted. Thank you so much, Michael, for taking the time to come and be with us and share this incredible wisdom with us today.
Well, I appreciate it. It's a labor of love, as you know. When you have an opportunity to meet all of these people and to be with them and to sit with them and to appreciate the depth and the wisdom that they are offering. As I said before we started, we literally have thousands of years of wisdom encapsulated in what these people are saying. If you add up their lifetimes and then the inspiration that led to their insights and so on, so you have this very distilled and extremely deep and rich archive to explore, and it really is designed to facilitate that exploration. So it's a blast.
Excellent. So where are we starting today?
Well, I basically would like to start by giving you some definitions. Did you share any of the document that I wrote to you, or should we go over them? I don't know. I have it here. I'm going to do this share screen thing. And then I'm going to go to this Word document, which I assume that you can see. Can you see it? Because I don't see you.
Yes.
All right. So I don't see any of you anymore. So I'm just going to go here real quick. So Touch the Future really began in a kind of a backwards way. In 1981, a colleague named Pat Hines was training for the 84 Olympics. And she swam from Catalina to L.A., and she rode her bicycle from Boston to Los Angeles in record time. And she was training on a Tuesday night, got home around 9, went to bed. Some guy broke into her apartment and for the next 3 hours decided to try to rape and murder her and beat her and humiliate her and do everything he could. She actually survived that. She was able to grab the knife at an opportune moment, chase the guy out and so on. We met a couple of days after that, and I held the question, why would anybody want to do such a thing? It was just inconceivable that somebody would want to do that. So why would a male want to do that to a woman, and he didn't even know her? So that's a totally thing. So I spent 2.5 years holding that question and interviewing forensic psychiatrists and victims and assailants and so on and so on and so on. So I really looked into the dark side of what we might say a breakdown in bonding. Basically, that's the root of it. When the bonding fails, then these pathologies unfold. And so Touch the Future is the light side. What if we do it right? So instead of looking at the dark side and all the bad stuff, I decided to flip the coin over and say, well, let's really model and look at what it looks like when you really do it well. So that's the whole focus of Touch the Future, is that we do touch the future by the environment we embody, by who we are, by the environments that we create and impose and control for children. So that's kind of what the definition of Touch the Future is. We do it all the time. It is what we call bonding. This idea of touching the future and epigenetics, you know, kind of blend, as I may go down when we do this. Joe Pierce, 50 years ago, talked about the model imperative. And the model imperative is essentially epigenetics. We are shaped by the environment, our DNA all the way up. So we touch the future. Touching the future is epigenetics in action, moment by moment, day by day. And the implications of this is to, when you really understand that, then your focus shifts on nurturing the environment. You want to create the richest, deepest, sanest, most nourished, and I'm even going to say evolved in terms of human beings. You want to create the most evolved environment possible, because the child spontaneously becomes what that environment is. So that's the idea how do I get back now to you? Stop sharing. Here we go. All right, there we go. So that's the idea. And Touch the Future has always been a focus on the environment, which is the parent when we're talking about childhood. So the real focus is really on the adult environment rather than on the kid. And most of our attention is, oh, the baby, and oh, the child, and so on and so forth. But the child's just acting out what the environment is. So this is really a misperception in my view. We should really be simply looking at always improving, expanding, nurturing the environment. And then the child's going to flourish naturally without any effort, without any rewards, without any punishments. They're going to flourish naturally. So if we have problems with children, we shouldn't be looking at the children. We should be looking at ourselves. That's the implication of this, and that's really what Touch the Future is about. So the Academy is a place where we can do that, where we can optimize ourselves. Again, we have to keep in mind that we're not trying to fix the kid. What we're really trying to do is optimize the environment, and if we do that, the child will be great, period. There's no exception to that. So How do you do that? How do you continue to grow and to learn? And basically, it's by your own experience and by getting in contact with these wonderful people that and exploring the insights that these wonderful people have offered. This self-discovery. Joe also said, becoming a parent is the most profound personal growth experience you'll ever have. So you're born into this world, and naturally you have this explosive growth period going on as a baby. 700 neurons per second, exponentially. Every second you get 700 more neurons to connect, 10,000 connections each. So this huge supernova explosion going on inside the baby. And there is not quite as dramatic, but a corresponding development period with the adult when they become a parent. So instead of looking at parenting as a dogmatic do as I say model, you look at parenting as literally the optimum environment for you to take your next developmental step. Parenting is a developmental stage, just like learning how to walk and talk is for a baby. So when you reframe the whole parenting journey in this way, that this is that I'm here to learn, I'm here to grow, I'm here to change and expand and discover things about myself and how to relate that I've never needed before. And that's what parenting is. So Touch the Future is built on that premise. Again, children aren't the object. The child is the catalyst for that growth and development. They're the mirror that we look at to continually grow and learn and so on and so forth. So that's a good beginning to redefine what Touch the Future means. So now when you hear Touch the Future, you can see that it's actually all about you and your growth and development, because if you do that well, the children that you come in contact will automatically be optimum as well. One of the other, so how did this all begin? My journey began way back in the early 1970s, not even as a parent, but really holding the question that I'm not who I think I am. That's a kind of mature way of phrasing it. I didn't quite know that when I was doing that, but who are we? You can see most of the pathologies that we carry around, most of the therapies that we need in order to fix us is because we don't feel comfortable with who we are. So this whole self-image deal becomes, one of the most important aspects or stumbling blocks to real development is our social image that we have about ourselves. So in optimizing the environment, we have to deal with our own stuff. So I've spent 40 years looking or holding that question, who are we? What are we as a human being? Are we who we think we are? If we're not, then what are we? Right? If we're not the social image. One of the people that we'll share a little bit with, Gabor Mate, has defined what we call the ego or self-image as a coping pattern. And what are we coping with? We're coping with culture. We're coping with society. We're coping with the do's and the don'ts and the rules and the regulations that are imposed by culture. And we develop our particular personality, that we call it, as a coping pattern to navigate the slings and arrows and pains and so on, and punishments and rewards and so on and so forth that is imposed by culture. That's not really who we are. You know, our personality, our self-image, our ego is really a coping pattern, not an identity. But we falsely identify with the coping pattern and give all our attention to the coping pattern instead of actually who we are. So this split is a fundamental one. So what we really want to do is deal with who we actually authentically are, rather than always being embedded in the social ego as a coping pattern to get through culture. So that's a big picture. And where that picture intersects is actually, there's very few teachers throughout history who have really focused on that. One is Buddhism, Buddha, Gautama Buddha. And a contemporary Buddha, actually, I can actually say that, this man named Krishnamurti, who I discovered in the mid-70s, I just published a book called Always Awakening, which was an interview with the first prime minister of Tibet in exile. And he's been as close to the Dalai Lama as you can get for ever since he was a child, trained by the same people and so on. And he spent a great deal of time with this man named Krishnamurti, and he says, basically, that he can see no difference between the authentic teachings of the Buddha and Krishnamurti. So Krishnamurti is a contemporary Buddha, is a nice way of phrasing that. And why this is significant is because classic Buddhism and Krishnamurti both deal specifically with this nature of the image that we have about ourselves, this stumbling block, this social stumbling block that causes us all these problems. Why the rapist rapes is because of this social image, right? So with that as background, I met Joe Pierce. My second son was about 1.5, and someone said, he was very precocious and so on and so forth. And they said, you have a magical child. And I said, what is that? And they said, there's this wonderful book. I went and read the book, and I had thought that I was planning on doing a PBS series on this new generation or this new parenting model. And Joe had already written the book, and I was really delighted that I didn't have to do that. So we met, we became great friends, and the rest is history. So what I'd like to do is, so this idea of bonding as an epigenetic field that we create, and that the child just becomes, they absorb that field, not through the intellect, but just the same way they learn how to walk and talk. So that's what bonding is this epigenetic field. And it's in a mirrored relationship moment by moment with the state of the adult. So the kid can't optimize that state, the adult has to optimize the state, that relationship. And if they do, then the childhood opens and flourishes and grows without pain, strain, or anything. It just opens naturally. So what I'd like to do is to begin some of the video clips and show you what we can do here. We'll go to Joe, but I mentioned connecting the dots, and connecting the dots is what the Academy allows us to do. And basically play, the role, the authentic play, real play, as opposed to cultural play. Cultural play is winning and losing in football and spelling bees and competition. All of those actually reinforce this ego structure. The whole competitive realm is really competitive, but that means comparative. And compare, what are you comparing? You're comparing your social coping pattern with the next guy's social coping pattern, and you duke it out and fight it out and see who prevails. But it's all based on the image. Real play doesn't have an image. There's no image. There's no ego image in the state of authentic play. That in order for real play to begin, that social image has to end. Then play can begin. And children play naturally because they're not so deeply embedded yet in that social image and so on and so forth. So the relationship of play as an optimum environment to grow and to learn, which is what play is a learning, growing experience, is the connecting dots piece here that I want to focus, because bonding is the nature of the quality of the play is a mere image of what the bond is. Does all that make sense? Is that good? Okay. So let's go to the academy. So I'm going to share this screen again. We're going to go to the academy. And we're going to go to this clip, which is now one of the things about the academy that I'll show you is that each one of these highlights gives you a theme. This is a whole idea. Each one of these is 2 or 3 minutes. So when you do a documentary and when you do an interview with someone, you basically ask them a bunch of questions. And normally when you're producing a program, you pull out the question that most represents what you're trying to share. And that's what you put in your film. But all the questions are interesting and important. All the stuff that gets thrown on the floor is only thrown on the floor because it doesn't fit your preconceived idea of what's important. But when you're connecting with this quality of people, everything they say is important. So what I've done is that I've taken these original interviews that may last an hour or 2 hours, and I've broken them up into the individual themes or questions so that you can scan over them. You can actually cover 2 hours of material and highlights in a minute. There's another area here, it's called advanced search. And if you click the advanced search, you get this board here. And it says that, okay, author, we're gonna go to Joseph Chilton Pierce. There he is. So we're gonna go Joseph Chilton Pierce, and we're gonna click over here, and we're gonna go to bonding. We're gonna go to bonding right there, and we're going to apply it. And what it's going to do is give me all of these clips by Joe that are dealing with bonding. So now there's 30 clips, something like that. There's a lot here that's dealing with bonding. So what I've done for you is actually create a documentary, because this would, you could do multiple people. You could do Ashley Montague, or you could go to anybody, and what anybody else has to say about bonding. You could get rid of this, and we go any, and we can go bonding and apply it, and you're going to get a different sort. There you go. Now instead of three, you've got all these. Tons of them. So all these are on bonding. All of these programs, all of these clips are on bonding. So that's what I want you to see, the advanced search. So what we're going to do is we're going to go now. The one other thing is that this is the Joseph Chilton Pierce Library. We have a lot on Joe. We have maybe 30 hours of Joe. It's a lot. I have the collected works of Jim Prescott. And you may know that Jim has done pioneering work in what is sensory deprivation. Sensory deprivation is the absence of touch and movement and play and bonding. Bev Boss is a preschool educator, she passed away last year. She actually and Joe both passed away within months of one another. Bev gave 6,000 workshops to preschool teachers and is my equivalent of Joe. Bev and Joe, Joe's got the intellectual stuff. Bev has it grounded in the sandbox. Keith Buzzell is a physician who has spent an enormous amount of time looking at what it means to be human. And the Krishnamurti Archive basically is a lot of material by Krishnamurti. There's a documentary and then a series of programs on the self on what is sacred, freedom and authority, change, meditation, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a huge thing here. And again, why do I include these people in a program devoted to child and so on and so forth? It's because the real focus is you. How do you become as mature and evolved as you can be? And some of these teachers will help you do that. So let's go back to the Joseph Chilton Pierce Library real quick. And we go to My Journey, which is where I think this one is. Yeah. And then number 8, which is a clip that I think will be great when we're talking about bonding. So here we go.
I would say, first of all, and strange enough, is to change the birth practice. That's the great criterion. The reason I'm saying is it currently is the most destructive force on earth, because were we not interfering intellectually, and essentially male intellect, with the intelligence of the species, the natural intelligence of the system, were we not doing that, we wouldn't have to educate mothers about the proper nurturing of children. That's been my whole thrust and my frustration. Do you have to educate a cat, a mother cat, to nurse her kittens? The idea of this United States Senate passing a bill that the hospitals must teach their mothers to breastfeed before they send the child home. You cannot teach breastfeeding. The minute it gets to the point where you need to teach it, you've lost the game already. So the whole issue is simply to stop intellectually interfering with the natural intelligence of the system. Here's where you really get right back to the savant practically. The intelligence is there. The woman has inherent, her brain enfolds. And we know even from MacLean's work, we think we even know the precise areas of the emotional relational brain and its connections with the frontal lobes that enfolds an intelligence that will always move for the well-being of the infant and the child. That's why you find in some of these pre-literate societies children who are 4 times more capable than our children simply denied the educational advantages that ours are. So you have this irony, you see, that when we intellectually interfere with intelligence, the intelligence that we need is not available. So the first thing is a radical, radical change in childbirth practices, not for the benefit of the child, but for the benefit of the woman. A true childbirth activates an intelligence enfolded within the mother's brain that then empowers her to make the proper response to the child. And then you don't have to go through any of these other systems, not in that respect. Then you're going to have a different child to deal with, and then you're going to have a different mother to deal with. Now the interesting thing is, at that point, you would have a person open and receptive to the explosive potentials within all the new research we've had. Why is it all the new research we have? And the frustration of many of these great people, such as Howard Gardner and Edelman and all the rest of them quite often, is that even their work falls on deaf ears. It never seems to filter down to the marketplace, to the man in the streets. Why? Because those people have no capacity. They're closed up already. So you have to go to the heart of the whole thing, which is the mother-infant bond and the role the father would play. And all that will take care of itself. But you've got to get to that and stop the intellectual interference of that intelligence from the beginning.
So there you go. Pretty good. Let me go on to another one here. This program called Ages and Stages is a 6-hour series that we did with Joe to kind of encapsulate his life's work. This is a breathtakingly complicated and wonderful tour. And let's see which one this one is. This is number 2. So the heart connection. So if you keep in mind what Joe just talked about, this this importance of connecting with the mother and so on, the role of the mother as a developmental stage for her.
Now, if we look at the connection with the heart, we get into some very interesting research. I've talked about the intelligence of the heart, and of course everyone assumes that this is a metaphor. And it is a metaphor, but it's also a fact. Years ago, they discovered there was something unique about a heart cell. The heart cell contracts and expands. It's different from neuron, which operates on a kind of a vibratory basis. You can take a heart cell out of the heart and put it in the right kind of a fluid and keep it alive for a while. You can't do that with a neuron. If you disconnect a neuron from its connection with other neurons, generally it dies immediately. It has to be in its resonant field in order to operate. But the interesting thing about the heart cell disconnected from the heart was that quickly it lost its rhythmic pulsation and began to fibrillate, that is, flop all around out of rhythm and soon destroy itself and die. Put two heart cells on the slide, and they would both fibrillate in that fashion. The poor little creature can't stand to be cut off from its matrix, from its source, and neither can we, I will say. If we're cut off from our heart, we fibrillate. It just takes us a little longer to die. Now, the interesting thing about these two heart cells is if you bring them close enough together, at a certain point of proximity, spatial proximity, they don't have to touch, there can be a physical barrier between, but at a certain point of spatial proximity, the two heart cells somehow or other communicate with one another and immediately go back into the synchronous rhythm with each other which they experienced in the heart itself. Now, this has never been able, we've never been able to explain that. Now, I know why, but this has to be hypothetical. And that is the intelligence which functions through the heart, which is nonverbal, non-personal, it's transpersonal, universal, simply moving for well-being and not individual or anything like that, that this intelligence is non-localized. And the two cells simply have to come into a certain proximity, and then they are sharing the same non-localized field, and they go back into their synchrony with each other. And now if you take the hundreds of billions of cells that go together to make up a heart, all functioning in absolute synchrony with each other, you can see that if one communicates, one cell can communicate with another across a spatial or physical barrier, then obviously two hearts have some form of communication as well. Now that has to be hypothetical, but there's a lot of evidence to back it up. Now let's look at some of the other evidence about the heart. This was years ago. Then came along John and Beatrice Lacey, Fells Institute, Yellow Springs, Ohio, operating under a government grant, an NIMH grant, did years of research into the heart and drew the conclusions that there was a direct and intimate dialogue between the heart and the brain, between the heart and the limbic system of the brain. The limbic system being what? The emotional cognitive structures of the brain that handle all relationships. Remember that? We talked about that earlier. This mammalian brain handles all emotions, all relationships, and that has, the Lacey's claim, direct, unmediated connections with the heart thumping away down in our chest, and that the brain was always informing the heart of its current experience in the world, and the heart was always exhorting the brain to make an appropriate response to the world. Now, that was their claim years ago. Since then, they spoke of this dialogue between the mind and the heart. Lots of other research on the heart has taken place. The discovery that between these cells of the heart, there are transmitters operating exactly as you have in the neurotransmitters of the brain, which means a great deal of communication is taking place on an individual level and on a collective level in this heart process. So with that as a preface, let's look at Whittleston's claim that the heart has a profound effect on the embryo, on the uterine, infant throughout the whole 9 months, and then at birth comes the greatest role of the heart. Researchers reading that the heart has an effect on the infant's brain and body went in back in the 60s and took recordings of a heartbeat and played them over loudspeakers in the nurseries of our hospitals where all of our newborns were isolated, of course, from their mothers. And it reduced crying by 40 to 50% right across the board. Now, a true scientific inquiry would have said why, and plumbed it to the depths to find why that profound effect on behavior would take place from an artificial, canned mother's heartbeat. Instead, those researchers rushed quickly to patent and market a rockabye teddy bear, which had within it a recorded heartbeat that could be played in the nursery at home to reduce crying by 40 to 50%, so the child's state of abandonment could be maintained and yet reduce the crying.
So that speaks for itself, I think. I would love to, let's pause for a minute and take a couple of questions, if there's any, before we go on. The implications here, if you, like you said, if you plumb this information, now you have the mother-infant separation issues. All the things that you talk about in APA are wrapped up into the separation of those two heart cells. Now, and all the communication that takes place instant by instant, both from a non-local, meaning energetic, almost like a radio transmitter level, and hormonally. So you have these two things going on. And when you separate the baby from the mom, this whole thing just falls to pieces. And this is, you know, a big, you know, really important part to your whole concept of bonding and why that heart to heart and why that skin to skin contact is so important. All the things that you've been looking at. So any questions for now, just real quick before we go on?
I'm not seeing any questions.
Okay.
There was some comments about just the, as a breastfeeding counselor, the idea of teaching breastfeeding.
Right.
And we can view it as reminding mothers of their innate intelligence. So there's a little bit of a conversation about that as well.
Sure,
so,
sure.
I don't know if you want to speak to that.
Well, again, Joe's basically saying that all of these patterns, all of these capacities, all of these intelligences have been built up in every female for millions and millions of years. And all we want to do, like Michelle Odant says, is get the intellect out of the way. And if we can get the intellect out of the way, then all of these natural processes unfold spontaneously and brilliantly and express naturally, because the child's presence is triggering the opening of that intelligence that wasn't there before. You didn't have to know about breastfeeding because you didn't have a baby. But now that you have a baby, the baby opens up all of these innate intelligences that will just unfold beautifully all by themselves. And then to teach means you're bringing the intellect in. You're going to go intellect to intellect and try to access these innate capacities through the intellect. And they're apples and oranges. So that's basically what it's talking about.
Okay. Babetta has a comment. So if you want to unmute yourself.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to make a comment on the concern from a breastfeeding educator standpoint, which I am, among other things, is we have created these vocations because the separation has already been instated for so long. And the vocations, we know we are trying to be helpful, but I don't think it should be taken as something that is to be offended by. But in fact, we do need to get the mother back to feeling more innate about it. And I think it's a disgusting thing, actually, in hospitals. I see nurses grabbing breasts and shoving them into babies' mouths and so forth. I definitely think there's a way to do it, and hopefully we can get this all back to mom and we'll lose her jobs. I think that'd be great.
Well, yeah, again, you have to take, you know, Joe's really talking about what he calls nature's agenda. You know, nature's agenda didn't have all the separation. It just all happened beautifully all by itself. And as he said at the very beginning, as soon as you have the intellect come in and try to call the shots, then you're superseding and kind of pushing aside the innate intelligence. And the intellect tries to do things. And the intellect that has been cut off from the intelligence of the heart, which is in a sense of appropriateness, is what he's really focusing on. So by cutting us, if we integrate heart and intellect, which which is what nature has in mind, the whole thing works beautifully. You know, that's what makes us human. But when the intellect is cut off from the intelligence of the heart, which means cut off from this intelligence and its appropriate response, then the intellect goes crazy, and that's what the Frankenstein monster is, and so on and so on and so forth. So at any rate, if you don't mind, let's go on to a couple other clips, because that's where I think the real value is. That good?
Yep.
Okay. So let's see. So let's go on to actually, I think what we're going to do is go to a different place altogether. We're going to go down to a department, and we have pregnancy, birth, and bonding as a department. So you have these libraries up on the top, which feature individual collections, but then you have the department, which is really where you're going to have lots of different people all housed under the same thing. So under video programs so this is so rich, Richard. This is the son of John Bowlby. You know Robbie Davis Floyd. Lloyd DeMouse and his history of childhood. Maryland, Ashley Montague is where we're going. So here's Ashley. Let me see which one we're talking. Here we go. Ashley Montague wrote 50 books on what it means to be human.
As I was a professor in medical school, I had abundant opportunities of speaking with mothers in the obstetrical departments whose babies in those days, in the early 30s and 40s, were taken away into a so-called nursery, which was so-called because no nursing was done in it, and the baby was literally abandoned to the prison in which it was put, with perpendicular bars on each side and white bed to lie on, white tiles crawling with staphylococci. And that was the way to deal with newborn babies. Now, if those babies had been completely abandoned, it couldn't have been much worse than what happened, because when those babies came back and I saw after 48 hours often, or even 24 hours, mothers would use the same phrase, "Hello, little stranger." And when I spoke with them, they all told me the same thing. If the baby hadn't been brought back, they wouldn't have noticed it. Well, bonding is a word, but what does it mean? What it means is to bond through the first language of communication between mother and infant, which of course develops eventually into eye contact, and you see the baby beginning to follow mother's eyes, movements, reading her face, her expressions, like a map, absolutely interpreting every expression. And the human face, it has been said, I don't know who counted them, is capable of about 250,000 different expressions. You have 16 muscles of expression on each side of your face and so on. So, but the tactile experience, it's eye contact is the technical phrase by people who didn't know much about this, but the touch of the eyes. And the touch of the eyes is very expressive, because it really means that you're doing what you're doing when you're actually touching the other body. And the expression of the eyes is, into our adult lives, very important. It tells the difference between indifference, between dislike, between love, friendship, and so on. And all this is connected into the word bonding. Well, the most important thing, of course, is the communication of love. The communication to the other that he has entered a safe harbor where he will be welcomed by everyone, nourished, nurtured, and given every encouragement to grow and develop into a healthy human being. And by a healthy human being, I mean the ability to love, the ability to work, the ability to play, and the ability to use your mind critically.
Ashley Montague. So what I'd like to do next is we're going to go to another department, which is going to go back over to Jim Prescott. And again, Ashley just talked about sensory, right? The whole thing, the whole world is sensory to the baby. So separation is sensory deprivation. If you take the baby away, you're talking about sensory deprivation. So let's look real quickly at what is sensory deprivation.
The developing brain through the body, and that's how it gets encoded. If we have pleasurable sensory stimuli, then that's the brain engrams the templates that will be stored. If they are painful, they're going to be images of pain, and pain evokes violent responses. But there's something else that evokes violent responses, and that's the absence of pleasure, and that's really different than the sensory event of pain, and most people don't really yet appreciate that distinction. And in fact, more damage occurs with the sensory deprivation of pleasure than the actual experiencing of physical painful trauma, which in fact can be handled quite well in individuals who are brought up with a great deal of physical, affectional bonding and pleasure, which carries with it emotional trust and security and so forth. So we really have to look at the trauma of sensory deprivation of physical pleasure. And that translates into the separation experiences, the isolation experiences of the infant from the mother. That's the beginning.
Some of these children at Lürhaus Institution in Munich have suffered brain damage. Some are mentally retarded. All have suffered the effects of disrupted maternal-infant relationship. The effects of early separation from their mothers upon children were noted in scientific publications some 25 years ago when psychiatrist Renee Spitz observed a high frequency of retarded development among institutionalized children. The English psychiatrist John Bowlby created controversy in 1944 with his conclusion that early separation leads to a character disorder marked by a lack of affection or feelings for anyone. These depressed children might be found in institutions around the world. They are withdrawn. Their pace of development has slowed. They are listless, vacant, unnaturally passive. They have few emotional contacts or relations with others, little spontaneity, no laughter, no tears.
What constitutes sensory deprivation? Because if you live in a culture in which you, the norm, the cultural norm, is you don't get touched very much, people don't perceive that as deprivation. It's like the converse issue of circumcision or genital mutilation. That is so commonplace in our culture that most people don't look at that as genital mutilation or as torture or as mutilation. It's so commonplace. It's the norm. So that's a very important question. So we have to go outside our own culture to get a different frame of reference, a different bearing, a different standard of what's normal. And not only outside of our own culture, excuse me, but also outside of our own species. And we are primates. And if you take a look at how other primates rear their infants, or even mammals with respect to mothers and their newborns, what do we see? We see an enormous amount of physical body contact. There's no mammal that separates the newborn from its mother at birth or any extended period after that, except a human mammal. Yet we do that routinely and isolate them.
So let's go forward now. You're getting this picture. The ideal is, as you all very well know, this rich sensory environment that the mother's body and her psyche and her emotions and all of that are transmitted. When we separate that, when we isolate them, you're cutting this off. It becomes a form of torture for that developing brain. This is really what Jim's research looked at. Now, what I want to go jump to quickly is Gabor Mate. Let me go to the introduction page. I think he's here. I just put him up here. So let's just watch the beginning of this, because what Gabor is doing is he's talking about what the lifelong implications are of both attachment when it all works well and the pathologies that occur when the bond doesn't work well.
Well, it's interesting to look at what happens when I, for example, speak to professional audiences. I mean, I speak to thousands of people every month. The most difficult audiences are the medical ones, who deal with the manifestations of early childhood loss, but they don't know that that's what they're dealing with. They think they're looking at diseases, symptoms, mental illness, dysfunctions, psychoses, behaviors that are categorized under one diagnosis or another. They don't realize that the commonality is the early childhood loss and trauma. I mean, you present them with that information, and you present it to them in detail with all the research parameters being covered, so that it's not just impressionistic or anecdotal, but actually research-based. They sit there stunned. They don't know what to do with it. And that's not my own, you know, if that was only my own failure to communicate, I could say, okay, well, if somebody else presented with them,
the video is stopped.
Michael looks frozen too.
Okay.
So I don't know what the deal is. So we'll have to wait for him to come back on.
Yep. We'll give him a moment.
Yeah. I hope you all are enjoying our resource we have here at APA. Such a great resource.
Yeah. And I know there's a whole conversation going on in the chat that I also just want to acknowledge, and I wanted to bring up with Michael. But, you know, the conversation about how these are all men and there are, you know, we're all women and these are men telling us what to do and sharing the research. And, I just want to say a lot of this, and somebody else brought this up too, a lot of this research was done a while ago. These are some of the people who did some of the initial research in that. And there are also lots of women on his academy as well. So you know, it's not necessarily a total bias thing, though it is interesting to notice that, yes, all of these people have been men, and yes, this is what we're talking about. So, but I wanted to have Michael talk about that, but hopefully he'll be back in a minute. We can ask him about that specifically. Because I know I've watched him go to conferences, and I've watched him pull Suzanne Arms, and I've watched him pull all of these amazing women and men who, it's like, we need all of the voices. We need all of them. And some people are going to hear it the way somebody says it, and they're not going to be able to hear it from somebody else. So we need as many voices as possible naming these things so that we can get it. I don't hear anything in the background, Barbara. I'm not sure what that is. So, yeah, hopefully Michael.
Well, I can ask a question for people, like, how many of you are actually, have you been into the using our resource, Touch the Future? Can I see a show of hands? How many of you gone in there? Shiva, Sally, and Stephanie. Yeah, so I mean, go in there. It's like Sandra, like it's Pamela. I mean, it's just an amazing sort of, you get in there and there's all kinds of, like, you sort of start to go down one way and then you see something else. And so you can, it does take time to get in there, but, and he's got some new interviews with, that are coming up from our last International Congress with Mary Jackson and Karen Strange, and I mean, he's got so much more material than is in there still. So there's all kinds.
Sorry.
Oh, are you back, Michael?
What happened? It just went away.
You went away.
So did I went away when you saw the Gabor Mate clip, or did you see?
Yeah, we were watching part of the Gabor Mate clip, and then it froze. The video froze, you froze, and then you went away.
I got it. All right. I'm so sorry about that. Shall we finish that clip?
Yes.
It's really a powerful clip.
Yes, please finish it.
All right. Let's go. Let me go back to sharing the screen.
Oh, there you
this
are.
This one and this one and that one. That's really terrible.
Your academy is so wonderful.
Thank you. It is. So here's, let's.
Vibe in the short term, but are the basis of pathology, physical illness, mental illness later on. And I presented this information to a group of pediatricians in a major Canadian city at Grand Rounds at a hospital. I said, look, in your own journal, here it is. I don't have to sweat anymore to prove this to you. I've been saying this for a long time. But here it is. They sat there in stunned silence. It's not that they argued with me. Had they argued and engaged, pointed out whether data was flawed or whether the logic was somehow inadequate, that would have been fine. No, they just didn't know what to do with it. Now, what that tells me is that on the part of particularly professionals, there's a difficulty accepting this material because they haven't dealt with their own stuff. So the barrier, to come back to your question, the barrier is people's own unresolved stuff that they haven't dealt with themselves. And there was an interesting study about climate change denial recently. It turns out that the more educated you are, if you're denying climate change, the more educated you are, the more entrenched you are in your denial. So it's not that education leads to more openness. Education leads to less openness. Because what it does is that the intellectual weapons that you gain and sharpen in the course of your postgraduate education actually allows you to use your weapon and to marshal them in the service of your denial. But the
So there you go. I mean, this is, you could, Gabor is one of the brightest guys on the planet as far as I'm concerned. He's just quite amazing. What I'd like to do is jump to another thing, because what the connecting the dots that is not usually explicit has to do with play. And what I want you to do is to understand that bonding, the experience of bonding is play. Authentic play is the experience, is the bonding experience. And that bonding experience continues over and over and over again at different ages and stages. And play is the way that that takes place. So let's go on to the imagination and play. And where is Stuart? He's here, but this isn't the clip that I want. Oh, here's the clip that I want. I'm going to have to go forward to the 13 minutes on this guy. What we're going to do is see what happens when play.
Otherwise, we're living somewhat like really smart, lizards with a really big brain we're not using, because we do stereotype, repetitive, habitual kinds of activities, which may have us survive, but also have us live our lives without much joy and without much real meaning. As Michael mentioned, 1966, Charles Whitman went up on top of the tower, shot all these people. He'd murdered his wife and mother the evening before. He was an Eagle Scout, A-minus student in architectural engineering, was considered kind of a golden boy. He was a former Marine. No one had had any idea that he was other than an appropriately mannered young man. And yet, without warning, he went up and did this. The times were, in 1968, the times were not good in the United States, assassinations, turbulence, Vietnam. John Connally was a governor of Texas, and Connally had been in the motorcade with Kennedy. So he gave us being our medical school and teams of people, through the Texas legislature, a huge amount of money, and said, find out why this guy did this. He said, there may be Whitmans behind every corner, and there are. And so I was allowed to run the psychological and psychiatric aspects. And my boss said, get anybody in the world you want to study this. So I could bring in any genius from anywhere. And so we got in the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology and did 50,000 brain sections. And anyhow, we did an extremely detailed biological review of Whitman's remains. He was killed in the incident. And we went back to his hometown, and I spoke to the doctor who delivered his mother, his preschool and school teachers, all of his relatives, an intact Catholic family that had been in Savannah, Georgia, and in Hollywood, Florida for three or four generations. And I really got a sense, as did the other members of our team, of getting to know this life history and his biology. And without expecting it, two things really came out of the woodwork from that study. I wouldn't say without expecting it. We knew there had been profound abuse and over-control by Whitman's father. But we didn't really know that Whitman had not engaged in play behavior. But every rock we turned over, we found a playless child. We found a child who was isolated, withdrawn, and although he could mimic in later years appropriate behavior, those who knew him well said he was never really spontaneous and involved in an empathic way. He wasn't robot-like, because he was very bright. He was intelligent enough to carry things off, but there was never an instance of spontaneous free play that I could find. And I could give you great detail on this. And this certainly got the attention of our team and led to our structuring, not just because of the play issue, but because we wanted to understand more and more what was behind violent behavior. So we spent a year or so studying most of the young murderers in the state of Texas. And this time, they were alive, could be interviewed, and this time we had a comparison control group to see how they were the same or different than this population under study in the prisons. And once again, abuse was found at the 90% level. Playlessness was found in the 90% level associated. And with a lot of other factors. Now, we did not conclude that lack of play causes homicide, and I don't want that to be the, you know, sort of the outcome of this. I'm really trying to talk about the positive elements of play. But when you see playlessness in a life, it's a very significant matter.
So our time is evaporating quickly. What I'd like to is connect these.
Uh-oh.
Yep, we've got another frozen spot.
Oh, no.
Yeah. He'll be back.
Yes, just hang with us a moment. Sally, you got a great question there. It's a whole other great conversation going on in the chat. It's like a whole other session happening. So hopefully Michael will be back with us in just a moment. Wow, yeah, the Touch the Future Academy is full of. I mean, I have gone in there and gotten lost for a couple of hours, and I've just scratched the surface. And even last month when we had Jim Prescott, and they were, you know, they were showing videos of that. Well, and yes, someone said, yes, they're traumatic. The monkeys, what happens to the monkeys is traumatic. Just seeing the research and understanding some of this stuff that I've never heard before, and I've been studying this for a long time. There's a lot of really great information in there. Yeah, and it does come with the program when you sign up for the PPNE program. So that is included in your education. So you have access to all of the materials in there as a part of your PPNE. This is why Kate was asking, how many of you as students have been in there? So, because it's hard to even figure out how to do it. You remind us how to log into the Touch the Future. I know that there's a whole process where you get an email with a special code for accessing Touch the Future as a student. So if you're having trouble, then would you send who should that person contact?
Mom,
Kate.
Yeah, Sally? Well, Gary and Michael. I mean, I think if there's technical difficulty getting into Touch the Future, we should orient, you know, just grab Gary and Michael. They have helped me previously, and also I just feel like it comes with, so we have, if you are a graduate or not a member of APA, we have a Friends of APA price that's on our website, birthpsychology.com. Just go to the front. It's under the announcement section. You can click on a link there and get a discount to become part of Touch the Future. And Michael does write blogs, and he's a parent, and he's written books, and so there's a lot of really great information just going to his website and, you know, beyond the academy that he's developed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's parenting a young daughter right now, and it's been really fascinating to hear his experience of actually applying the information to parenting. That was one of Karen Melton's questions at the beginning, is he even a parent? You know,
yeah,
and he's got grown kids, and then he's actively parenting right now. And the stories and the things that he writes about, I mean, he's really living this information. It's not just a theoretical thing.
And so he's a beautiful writer, too. And there's a great section on play, and just like I do a lot of play with parents in my private practice, and having a child is a healing time, and it can really change. I know we've called it the hero's journey, but it's also a healing journey, and so play is a chance for all of us to engage in our nervous systems in a different way. And really make some changes. So how do I incorporate play with parents? What's part of the training that you get when you become a professional in the pre and perinatal somatic side? We're taught to play. And a lot of times we work with birth games or attachment games, ways to connect with parents. Oh, Michael, you're here.
Michael back.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. It just, my internet connection just bounced in and out. So that's what it is. So sorry about that.
And we were back. We were just talking about how more about your academy, and you have a big section on play in there. So
yeah, the point that I would like to say is that, you know, we, if you think about bonding or attachment, how do we, you know, attachment is really expressed through play. Not in a cultural play, but in what's called original play, and that's what this is all about. How do we touch and move and connect and so on and so forth? So play is basically the way that bonding or relationship unfolds in its optimum way. And my first book with Joe, called Magical Parent, Magical Child, is saying, all right, what is the optimum state for learning and performance? Well, it happens to be play. All right, well, what is play? Athletes call this optimum state the zone. And researchers call it flow, and children call it play. And there's certain qualities in this state that makes it the optimum one, because that's what nature intended. So if the zone is the best place to be in as you kick a ball, it's also the best state to be in as you parent your children. So that whole first book was really saying, how do we get parents to move into the state of authentic play with their children so that they're in this optimum state? Now you have coherence between the state of the child, because they're already in play, and the adult is now in play, and you have coherence instead of conflict in the relationship, and it just flows like surfing. I use that as a metaphor, skiing, but surfing is even better than skiing, because you've got a moving target with the wave, whereas the ski slope is fixed. So play is the way that bonding unfolds continually throughout life, and et cetera, et cetera. So that was connecting the dots. But the other area about connecting the dots has to do with what happens when there's play deprivation, when there is sensory deprivation. This is where Prescott came in. This is where Gabor came in. So if you really kind of bore into what these commonalities from Montague, what he was saying, you get this big picture here of what's going on. And then you look at kids and you look at what play is, the absence of going outside, the absence of running and jumping and moving and so on, more with their fingers and with screens, less outside, less connection with other life forms, and rather connecting, playing with technology instead of living forms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these are huge, huge areas, all have their grounding in what you folks are doing every day with pre and perinatal psychology in this early sensitive period. If you get it straight and you get it good at the beginning, the whole thing has a great trajectory. It's pretty easy. It's a joy. It's fun. It's great. If you screw it up at the beginning, then it just kind of is a bumpy road for everybody forever. So that's the connecting dots that you have here. So happy to take any questions.
Sandra, we have a question. Do you want to go ahead and ask Michael?
Yes, Michael. I deal with a lot of play therapy with children, and I'm noticing that children coming from very toxic wombs seem to have a difficult time reacting to healthy play. And I'm wondering, is that actually due to the prenatal environment, or is there a way that we can change it?
Well, again, I've toxic womb. I mean, that could be poisons. That could be toxicity in the physical toxicity. But I really look at the overall gestalt. I look at the psyche of the mom. I look at the relationship of the parent. I look at the whole gestalt of all of these factors. Yes, there may be toxicity in terms of, if you're using the word in that way, but a child that's in a playless or over-controlling, domineering environment, this absence of original play, authentic, true play, permeates the church, it permeates society, the whole school system is pretty much play deprivation. When you really step back and look at the whole culture, we are in a play deprived culture, which we could say is a sensory deprivation culture. And then you look at what Gabor is talking about, and you look at what Jim is talking about, and you see what we're actually up against. So I can't answer your question any other way. you know, how do you help a play deprived child is to, you know, inch them along. The challenge, as you all know, is that we open up our capacities in this developmental hierarchy. And once we pass the optimum windows where those core capacities unfold, new ones kind of fold up on top of it and it gets buried, and it's very hard to get back to those early patterns and be remedial. We have tremendous amount of energy invested with a pretty small outcome because of the wiring of the system. So it's a big deal. I don't know if that's addressing your question or not.
Yeah, thank you.
Monica, I see that you've got a lot of conversation over here. Is there anything that you would like to say or ask Michael? You can just unmute yourself if you'd like. Monica Hudson. I'm going to unmute you. There you go. Is there anything you'd like to say or share or ask? Okay. All right. I just want to give you an opportunity. You've got a lot of great discussion going on over there. So, okay. Anyone else have anything that you would like to ask Michael while he's here with us? I know there was a discussion that while you were gone where they were talking, some of the people were talking about how, yes, it's all men. You know, you've got all these men and we're talking about women and, you know, women's intuition and all of that. So I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that. And I mean, you've got great, great people who are saying what you want, you know, what you're trying to convey. So.
Well, again, I picked, you know, I do have women on.
That's what I said.
they're not all men. You know, I don't know what to say. You know, I've got Suzanne and Robbie and, you know, a lot of other wonderful people who have been out there for years. But as you see from a research standpoint, Joe happens to be Joe. I mean, you know, and many of these people, many of these men are talking about what men's brains and their intellect have done to them, right? The reason that they, all of them, all these people that were taught, every single male is passionate about this because of what was done to them by the male culture, and they realize that. So Prescott is right up there, Gabor's right up there, all of them have this commonality. Joe's opening line was intellectual interference with this billions of year old process reaps disaster at every turn. So, and that's the male, primarily the male intellect. There was a book that came out called The Myth of Eden, and it was an anthropological look at the Garden of Eden story. And what was that? The Garden of Eden story was essentially having what they call the God in the sky having to literally dethrone the goddess. God in the sky literally dethroned and essentially raped the goddess, turned her into a witch, right? In order for the intellectual concept of God in the sky to reign supreme over the innate intelligence of the body. Now this is 300 BC or something. We're talking way back then. And we're actually still playing out that exact same thing,
right?
Which is this explosion of the capacity to imagine, the intellect. This is why imagination is so important. You have to really understand the role of imagination and at a deep level, and we don't. We don't understand the basic operating system that we're dealing with, which is the way thought works and the way that imagination works. We are seduced by our own imaginations. We personify it as an ego, and that's exactly what God in the sky is simply a personified ego projected up there as being all powerful. And then we have to, that intellect, abstract image of the intellect has to overreign and basically subjugate every other process, which is nature. All other intelligence have to fall under God in the sky as an abstraction. And we're still playing out the same drama because we haven't really discovered within ourselves this thing. What is imagination? What is thought? How does it work? We don't look at that. We just think that we should think better thoughts without looking at the operating system.
Thank you for that, Michael. All right. Well, we are a little past our time, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap up. But if people want to contact you, is Touch the Future the best place? Or
Yeah. Michael@ttfuture.org.
All right. So feel free to reach out if you've got another question or if you want more information on Touch the Future Academy. And if you need help accessing it, just let us know and we'll put you in touch with the people who can help you to do that. So got a lot of thank yous going on right now. So thank you so much, Michael. We really appreciate your time and your expertise and sharing these visionaries with us.
You're quite welcome. Take care.